family, welcome to The Village Talk, the podcast that highlights and celebrates amazing women of color making a difference in their communities every day, and the village that supports them, because you know, it takes a village. I am your host, Victoria Downs, and I am so excited to share the space with you. Let's get into it.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Village Talk. I'm really excited for this episode because I have the amazing Laverne Gordon with me today. She's the founder of the Love Life Now Foundation, which promotes year-round awareness around domestic violence via its initiatives, which help people pull in the right direction for help and also helps to bridge the gap between shelters and the communities that they serve. She's also the author of The Legacy He Left Me, a domestic violence memoir. If you didn't get the gist of today's episode from the description, trigger warning, we're going to be discussing domestic violence today. So excited to have Laverne on the mic with me because her story is so fascinating, so inspiring. I've been watching you for a minute, Laverne, and I'm like, I cannot wait to get into her backstory because I need to learn about how she is the woman that she is today. So welcome to the show and thank you so much for gracing us.
So happy to be here and thank you for having me, Victoria.
Okay, awesome. So excited to get into your story. Thank you for sharing that with us. Now, tell us about, like, you know, your upbringing, where you grew up and how you grew up.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I am from an island called Trinidad and Tobago. It's the last island going down that way, just above Venezuela. And for the entire time that I lived there, for about 15 years, our father unfortunately brutally abused our mother. And, you know, it wasn't just our household. There were many households in the neighborhood that perpetuated the idea of abuse was love, and also beat on children. This was our complete normal day to day. And, you know, the entire time I said to myself, I would never want anybody to treat me the way my father treated our mother. It was completely disrespectful. I saw her as weak for staying for many years, not realizing the extent of what she was going through emotionally and mentally. And I saw him as powerful, and I hated him to some degree. It was a love-hate relationship that I had with my father because on one hand, I loved the fact that he was educated, articulate, well-read, well-spoken. I wanted those things. And I hated the fact that my mother was uneducated, you know, financially dependent on our father. And again, I saw that as weak and I wanted to be more like him in that regard. But then at the same time, I hated what he was doing to her and my older siblings, which, you know, two of them, the older ones, were about 7 years apart from me. So by the time I came around 6, 7 years old and watching them get the brunt of the child abuse, I knew that I wanted none of what he was dishing out. So I tried to be, as the middle child, the best that I could be. He wanted us to go to school and get good grades. I went to school and got good grades. He wanted us to be, you know, well-liked in the neighborhood. I did as much and helped people around the neighborhood and was the nice neighborly child. And I also did as much as I can around the house to excel in whatever it is that he thought was good, quote unquote good. And so by the time I was 15, my grandparents, who lived in the States since the 70s, had wrote him a letter asking him if he would allow me to migrate to the States to finish high school. And unbeknownst to my surprise, he allowed it. He wanted me to come out to the States and finish school. He believed, as well as they, that I had a, you know, better chance at excelling and doing well and maximizing my potential here. And so I migrated to the States. I lived with my grandparents, leaving my siblings and my mom and my father behind. Did well here, finished high school, and then had to go back to Trinidad for a couple more years to get my permanent residency status at the time set. And when I went back, by this time, now I'm 18 years old, and our older siblings are also older, and my younger siblings are also older. And we all were not standing for our father to put his hands on our mother. We I remember as clear as day the first time that I, you know, when I went back, I'm 18, and it was probably about 2 weeks in that I had been back, and everything was great. Until this one day, I could see that he was priming up to physically attack her. And in my mind, I was saying to myself, my God, this thing, things like this are still happening from this guy. And I was so upset that I approached him and I said, listen, you can say what you want, but you don't you dare put your hands on her. And I called my older brother, who again is now older, bigger, taller than her father, and had retaliated against him many times. He couldn't coexist in the same space, and he moved next door to where we live. So I called my brother for sort of like a reinforcement backup. And I said, you know, he's trying to act up, our father that is. And he came and he really reiterated what I had said. He said, you can say what you want, but don't you dare touch her. And he knew that we both meant business, right? And he backed down. He backed down because we were now speaking out against what he was doing to her. He couldn't do it to us, right? Because we were grown now. We had more sense. We had more, you know, braveness, you know, behind us. But my mom was still mentally and emotionally wrapped up in his torture that she would never step out against him. And so in doing that over the next couple of years, I believe that he began to realize that he could no longer physically beat on her the way that he did. And I believe that he knew that he was losing some of the power and control he had over her, which is what this issue entails overall, power and control. So that was my upbringing. You know, by the time 2 years later, you know, after I'd returned to Trinidad, my permanent residency was set, but my mom's permanent residency was also set because it was her parents that had filed for me. She had then filed for her and her immediate younger siblings, children as well. So that meant myself, my two youngest brothers, and her were all eligible to migrate to the States at that point. And my father let her go because, again, I believe that he knew that he was losing power and control over her, and that, you know, the way that he wanted to treat her, it would no longer be accessible. And he let her go. So that was my years in Trinidad, and being under my father's regime.
Wow.
Then migrating to the States and believing in myself wholeheartedly, Victoria, that what had happened to her would never be me. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, children that grow up in those types of settings, abusive, traumatic settings, they typically tend to go on to become the abuser or mm-hmm. the victim.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, because yeah. you learn what you see, right?
Regardless, learned behavior.
It's learned behavior 90% of the time. And so I was no exception. I was the only one out of my siblings that became a victim. Wow. I was now 21 at the time that I came back to the States. So I'm now 2 years behind my peers who had started, you know, school right after college, right after high school. So I had to get on the ball, right? So I started and got accepted to Suffolk University, where I went and was starting to study advertising and marketing. And I started an entry-level job in corporate America. I ended up at a commercial finance leasing firm, but after I had, you know, done some secretarial work for more than a few years. And when I ended up at this commercial leasing firm, banking and finance, I'm thinking to myself, okay, Laverne, you've got it all together. You're 21, you know, you're going to get your place soon at some point. You're working a job, like you're nothing like who your mother was. You love her dearly, but you're nothing in my eyes. I was not weak. I was a social butterfly. I was independent. And I thought I had it all together. And I met this guy, and he was about 10 years my senior. And things, you know, we started dating after about a few weeks, a month. He had been trying to get my attention, finally gave in. We started dating. Things were great. I think, let me tell you something. At 21, when a guy is taking you on lavish dates yeah. and buying you flowers and opening car doors, this is not your island, you know, love life style, mm-hmm. right? This was straight out of a Hallmark movie. Like, he swept me off my feet, and I had never had that type of intense And not in a bad way, but just in the level of attention that I was given. I had never had that type of relationship with anybody before. And I'm saying to myself, man, what did I do to deserve this guy? I'm so, you know, in love, like real, like it must have been a month. Like we were saying, I love you, right? And to me, things were great. I had missed a lot of the red flags in the first 3 months of the relationship because with that intense, you know, attention that was coming my way, it meant that he was always calling me. And I didn't understand that that meant that he wanted to check up on me and make sure I was where I said I was. So I didn't take it as anything. I thought, well, oh my God, he cares about me so much. And he wants to make sure I'm safe. And this is great, you know? And so 3 months into the relationship, we were doing great, but this particular morning I had gotten up and had been suffering from the very bad allergies, which I still suffer from today, but I didn't know what it was. And so I thought it was a bad cold. I called the office and I told them that I wouldn't be in and I would, you know, see them the next day, and, went back to bed. About 15 minutes later, he called my phone and was insanely irate that I hadn't checked in with him that morning. Again, before I even got to work to the office, I would get at least 4 calls from him, all making sure I was where I said I was before leaving the house in the, you know, on my way to work. And so he was pretty irate that I hadn't checked in and the fact that I was home, you know, randomly to him. I tried to explain to him that I was sick, kind of made some jokes about it. And he hung up the phone in my ear. And before I knew it, he was at my house that morning, barged past me, went into the room that I occupied at my grandparents' house, started rummaging through my stuff, real paranoid behavior. And then accusing me of staying home to be with a guy. And I'm like, what? I said, I love you. I said, I just feel sick. Well, why are you wearing that type of nightgown? I said, because I was in bed. You know, he was just acting real crazy. And it was almost like this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde thing just happening before my eyes. And so, I couldn't
understand. Wait, hold on. Mm-hmm. This is 3 months into the relationship?
3 months. He flipped. And I am saying to myself, so first of all, I'm scared because I'd never seen this side of him. And he was light skinned. So his face was like getting very red. And I'm saying to myself, like, my God. And I'm trying to tell him the truth that I am sick. And, you know, I'm glad he's here and nobody's been here. It's just been me. Didn't want to hear it. I'm now sitting at the edge of the bed. And he came up to me and I'm sitting, he's standing and he says, you know, I knew you were too good to be true. And then he slapped me really hard in the face, so hard that I saw stars. And then he stormed out, left. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying to myself, my God, what did I do to bring this on? Like, I told the truth. Why didn't he believe me? Maybe I should have called him. And then I was like, no. I didn't do anything. I told the truth. So now I'm done. You know, we don't have any kids together. We're not married. So I'm over this, right? And for that entire weekend, I turned my phone off. I didn't want to hear from him. And I had made up my mind.
Oh, I have so many questions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. When this happened, and the entire weekend you turned your phone off, What were you thinking in that time period? Like, were you still stunned? I know you decided that you were going to cut him off, but I, you know, like you told us earlier that you got to the point in your life where you were like, you know, I'm nothing like what I saw growing up because what I saw growing up was tragic.
That's a great point. And so in that moment, when I decided that I had cut him off, there were a couple of things that ran through my mind. That this particular weekend where I didn't want to hear from him, I had began to sort of run through the incident over and over again. I started to doubt myself and then I undoubted myself, right? If that's even a word. So I was going back and forth with reassuring myself that I had done the right thing. But at times, I'm not going to lie, I kept saying to myself, well, maybe I overreacted. But then I'd pull myself back and say, no, never once did I equate what had happened to me at that point with what my mother had gone through, because I saw it as the idea was that I did something to stop it. I had full control over what was going to happen next. And what was going to happen next is that if he tried to call me, I'm not picking up the phone because my phone's off. I don't want to hear from him. I had actually took a bus trip to New York. I don't know if you remember those bus shopping trips where you board the bus in Chinatown, 6 o'clock.
My husband and I used to organize them for the church.
Oh my gosh. Yes, those were the business. And this was the first time I had ever done one on my own. I had promised myself one. And instead of coming back on the 6 o'clock bus that evening, I stayed. I rented a motel. I got my hair done. So it was a whole weekend away to just sort of get my mind right, doubt myself, undoubt myself, and just be okay with the decision. Because I also was infatuated with the whole, you know, it was 3 months without nothing happening. And then this thing happened. And maybe I overreacted. So all of these things. But again, feeling like I was in control because I had made the decision that if he called or even if he tried to call, I wouldn't let him have the floor.
Right. When I came back. Did you tell anybody?
No. Oh my God. So even though I knew that it wasn't, or in my eyes, that it wasn't anywhere near what my mother had went through, I still felt ashamed. Because I knew it was something in relation to what she had gone through. However, it wasn't anywhere on that level. And I had control. It was a one and done thing. I don't want anybody to know. Because again, I had associated victimhood with being weak. And I didn't want anybody to look at me as weak. I had it together. At least I thought I was supposed to be having it together. And when I got back that Sunday, my brother had met me. First of all, I told my two younger brothers, if such and such comes by, don't tell him that I went to New York. Don't anything. I said, I just need some time. And they said, okay. The brother that's just after me, 2 years younger than me, he met me at the door when I came back that Sunday night. And he said, such and such came by to drop off something for you. And when I went into my room, it was 2 dozen purple roses. My favorite color. And there was a card with it that said, I love you. I miss you. I'm worried. Call me. So he had been trying to call. And then when I turned on my phone, there were a slew of messages from him sounding very panicked that he couldn't get in touch with me. And in that moment, I again really doubted myself. So all the work that I had done over the weekend to try to forget him, it couldn't easily be erased like that. Hearing those messages, reading the card, seeing the flowers, in my mind, I decided that I was going to give him the floor because I equated now for real what my mother had went through with what I was now going through. And I said to myself, it's not that bad. And it was just a slap. And he's saying that he's sorry. This is now when I, you know, called him and, you know, I told him I went to New York and that I thought I was through with him. He begged. He said, listen, I'm so sorry, baby. I love you so much. The thought of you being with somebody else just drove me crazy. I apologize for what I did, but you know, you made me do that because you didn't call. And so in that apology, another big red flag was him deflecting blame about what had happened on me. And I didn't catch it at the time, right? This was years later, I realized, like, my God, even then, in his very first apology, he made it seem that I caused this by not calling and checking in with him. And I made him think that, you know, something was off between us because I went outside of our routine when it was really his routine I took the apology. I equated it again with my mom's situation. I said, you know what? In my mind, I still have control. I'm accepting his apology. And you know what? My father never went to these type of lengths to apologize to my mother. He must mean it. I mean, it was only one time. He's been great for 3 months. It was only one incident. And a lot of people ask, a lot of the times, how do victims get into these types of relationships? I would never let myself go there. Like, if that happened to me, that would never be me. And I'm telling you, I say this all the time. I considered myself, and this is not to toot my own horn, but I considered myself a smart person. But here I was accepting this apology and slowly gauging myself into this type of mindset that somehow I was to accept part of the blame for his actions. And mentally, and you know, when you go through this issue and you're faced with it, you wonder to yourself, like, maybe what he's saying, because that's what you're hearing from the abuser. It's like, you caused this. Well, maybe I did. You know?
You start to doubt yourself.
And so it's like, well, everything else has been good. And we have kids together and he is a good father. So maybe I just need to do better. You know, right. Like all these scenarios keep playing in your head and you wonder, like from the outside looking in, like that would never be me. But then when it's not until you're faced with it, you're like, okay. Right. So here I am. I accepted that apology, and that, Victoria, then led to almost 2 years of physical, emotional, and verbal abuse. He just kept upping the ante every time. And sometimes something happened. And so I stayed in the relationship for almost 2 years until I got to my breaking point. I'm not going to give away all the details of the book, but I can say that when I got to the end and I realized that this wasn't where I needed to be, that if I had stayed, that he would eventually really disfigure me or hurt me really bad, like really, really, really bad. Not that all the other attacks weren't bad, but this particular night that he beat on me the last time was a typical full-on attack, but with added torture. So it started from like 9 o'clock the night before, and it went till about 2 o'clock the next morning. He would stop, he would go, he would stop, he would go, he would strangle, he would hit about the upper torso. He was spitting in my face. He was slapping me. So he never slapped me from that first incident. It was always about the body because he knew I worked in a corporate setting and people would ask questions if they saw marks, you know, on my neck or whatever. And so, you know, this particular night, that was out the door. He had brought a knife from the kitchen to the bedroom space. I'm now living in my own studio apartment. That he would frequent. And this night he went off the rails. He had found a picture that had moved with me many times over. This particular book, I had a stack of books that had moved with me over the years from since 1993. My aunt had given me Waiting to Exhale by Terry McMillan. And it was one of the novels in this stack. And he's going through these books because he was always paranoid, looking for something to pin on me that he could never find to validate his idea of me cheating on him. And I didn't realize that this jealousy and this paranoia was relegated to his insecurity. It had nothing to do with me because I knew I wasn't cheating. I knew that I was faithful in the relationship, but he was always looking for something to validate it. And even if he never found anything, it would always still end up as an attack, whether it be verbal, emotional, or physical. And so, like I said, he's going through these books and out pops this picture. He looks at the picture and he looks at me and then he flings the picture at me. And when I picked up the picture, I died inside because I knew what he was thinking. It was an old picture of me from like 1991 or 92 of me and my ex-boyfriend from Trinidad, sitting on the beach, hugged up on the sand, looking very happy. And I'd used it as a bookmark when I had moved back to the States in 1998. And it left it there. And never thought about it again until this thing popped out of this book. And that sent him into like a frenzy. And he, like I said, this was the first time he reached for a knife. He would press the knife up against my throat to let me know that he could slit my throat at any time. And spit in my face, strangle me. There was a couple times where I, you know, passed out, came through, and he was punching on me or pacing the floor. And then when he was done at about 2 o'clock the morning, he just went to bed next to me in my bed like nothing had happened. What did I do? I laid next to him because where am I going to go? By this time now, I'm isolated from family and friends. I don't want, as I said, shame. I don't want to tell anybody that this is happening. How could the smartest one of the bunch let herself fall into this type of relationship is what I was thinking people would say to me. And I just really wanted no part of it.
So for the 2 years that you were in that relationship, you never told anyone?
There was no way that I wanted anybody to know. So now I'm living in the studio apartment. I live directly at the corner of Ashmont Street and Dorchester Ave. There's a brick building there next to the train station, apartment building. And that was where I lived. And it was a, you know, bunch of mixed professionals that lived there. And, you know, so again, so this image that I had for myself, I again thought that if anybody knew what was happening to me, that they would shame me. They would blame me. Still going through Suffolk University. So the first year I was flunking all my classes. I did 1 year at Suffolk and I was failing miserably. If I had a group project to do, and it involved guys being in that group, he would call and ask me to leave early because he was paranoid about the men possibly trying to pick me up. if you could see my face of disgust, you would know how disgusted I was with myself that he would, you know, he was able to sort of pull me out from, you know, work projects, school work projects that I was failing subjects miserably. And then even at work, he would show up randomly to accost me for the short dress. If my dress was too short in his eyes, if the underwear was too skimpy, if my hair was a different way, he attributed it all to me potentially flirting with guys or guys wanting to potentially flirt with me. I would get accosted on the first floor of my building and then go to the bathroom, clean my face up like nothing had happened and go back to my desk like everything is okay.
So let me ask you this. While you're in this relationship and dealing with all of this and you're trying to balance, I'm not crazy, I'm not wrong, I'm not doing anything wrong. Are you trying to fix and get him to see that you're not doing things wrong? Like, I'm just curious, like after the first few times, so it happened the first time and then you went back in, right? And it progressively got worse. What was your objective in knowing that this gets worse every time?
To make
it
work.
Happens. Yeah.
To make it work. I was being told over and over again that I was the problem, right? So that it was only that one time that he took maybe partially part of the blame. Everything else going forward was my fault. If you hadn't, this wouldn't have happened. If you had just, I wouldn't have acted this way. And you're hearing that umpteen times, it's going to seep in and you're going to believe it. Nobody's going to love you like I love you. They don't understand our relationship. She's just jealous of what you have. You don't need to talk to him. He's trying to get in your pants. You're hearing these things constantly. And eventually you absolutely believe it. I swear to God. So here I was just trying to fix this. And now this was patterned behavior that I had witnessed as a child from our father against our mother. She was always to blame. She needed to fix it. And so I grew up in my house, my specific household, watching her fix things. Okay. You can make this stop if you just fix it. And so that behavior or that pattern of behavior seeped into your head as a child. It walks with you. People often ask, you know, how do abusers, you know, develop this type of attitude? Well, it's learned. Whether they like it or not, a lot of the times it's learned behavior. Just as victims can, you know to themselves, this is how I'm going to receive love in the long run, even though you subconsciously tell yourself, no, that that's not what's going to happen. It's the same way as abusers. They develop this mentality that this is how you gain love, power, and respect. How often do we hear our you know, society saying that, you know, boys need to be tough. Boys don't cry. If you want respect, you have to go get it. You have to demand it. And girls, they have to be fixers. You have to fix things. If there's something wrong in the marriage, what did you do to make that not work? He's a good man. Like, just go home and fix things. You know, dress nicer, be sexier, let your hair down. You know, take care of the children better. Like, we're always being told, not just within our own households, but society's messaging is saying that we need to fix things. And so I absolutely was no exception. And then working in an office, as far as it related to work, not being able to even want to tell anyone there, I'm one of two Black women in my company.
Right.
There's no way. The stereotype that I had learned of Black women once I came to the States was that, you know, Black women bring drama. Black women are drama. I didn't want that, right? And then thinking to myself, if my principal knew that this was what was happening to me, she'd fire me. That's what I was thinking. Crazy. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't true. But that's the mindset that I had in my head because, you know, that's the stereotype I was left in. So one of two Black women in my office, there was no way that I was going to let on as to what was happening there. And then school, my God, there's a bunch of, you know, rich kids from Saudi Arabia and Iran and all these other places. And here I am coming with this stuff to my professor saying, you know, I'm having real difficulty because I'm getting beat on at home. And be like, well, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, they'll probably tell me that I don't need to be in this program, that I need to go deal with what I need to deal with, right? And so I was just trying to what did I say, in survival mode, just trying to keep it together at the time and juggle all these things while wearing a mask. And that's, if you see the cover for the book, that really is what it speaks to, is walking around with all this stuff while you have to present this face that everything is okay.
Putting up appearances, really. Putting up appearances.
Yeah. So it's like with emotional scars underneath.
Right. There's a lot of different points that you made, a lot of different gems that you dropped around, like just the appearances, and like in every different setting that you belonged in, you didn't feel comfortable enough to peel back the mask and say, I'm hurting, I need help.
No,
right. And it was the shame, right? And in the meantime, you're still trying to fix things at home
to make it work, because
to make it work,
that I am the problem.
But this
particular night, Victoria, when he went in, this was the longest attack, this was the worst attack. Couple hours, I laid in that bed next to him, whimpering very softly, because with all the blows that I was getting, I also never wanted my neighbors to hear. I know they probably did, but I always tried my best to keep it down, right? So that the neighbors won't hear. And I always had like this excuse ready that if anybody asked me, are you okay? I would always, you know, I had it ready in my mind that I would say, oh, that was the TV, you know, because I would let him have the floor, right? And if, you know, God forbid somebody said anything, I'd be like, oh, that's, he's always yelling at the game, you know, he's always kind of getting upset about the game. So anyway, this particular night, 4 o'clock in the morning, I got the sharpest pains from this particular attack. And I knew that something was really wrong and not normal from those other attacks. And I decided, okay, do you stay here? I've watched enough movies to know that you could be internally bleeding. You could have some broken rib somewhere. So do you just stay here? If you're internally bleeding, do you die here? Will he's not going to go get help because he's not going to get himself in trouble, or do you get up and get help? And I decided to get up and get help. So I quietly escaped that night, left the house, put on a pair of jeans, a little top, limped down the stairs because I was on the third floor and there was no elevator, and got the first cab because, again, I lived next to the train station. When I got to the first light between my house and Kearney Hospital, he pulled up. He realized that I had left and followed me in the cab and yelling profanities to get out the effing car and this, that, and the other. And I said to the driver, I said, please, I am begging you, if you have to run the red light, please do it and get me to the hospital, because that man is trying to kill me. And if you let me out of this cab, I'm as much as dead. And he listened to me. He didn't say a word and he ran the red light. And then, you know, my abuser then started drag racing the cab until he saw that it pulled into Kearney Hospital. Because in his mind, he believed that I was now for the very first time going to say something. I didn't realize how much power I had in using my voice at the time. All I know is that I'm 23. I just escaped this attack from this man who has keys to my house that can come and find me at any time. And I just needed to figure out what was going on with me. And though all of that was going on, I still loved him. I just wanted the abuse to stop. Like, quite honestly, that's all I was trying to fix throughout the relationship, is that I just wanted the guy that I fell in love with for those first 3 months, the guy who he portrayed himself to be, but really never was. It was all just sort of a ruse to reel me in. But, you know, I got to the ER and I told the triage nurse that I had fallen in the shower. I told her I had hit certain places, like where the pains were. They ran x-rays, and it wasn't until the ER doctor came in the room that I had to fess up, because he looked at the x-rays and he said, you know, these injuries aren't consistent with you falling in the shower. Who did this to you? He knew right away. And I was ashamed. And even though I fessed up, I begged him not to call the police, because I just wanted to go home, right? I wanted to go home where I thought it was safe, not understanding that that was the most dangerous time for me. When victims decide to leave these relationships, that's when abusers get beside themselves and say, not over my dead body, right? How many of you hear the news too often? She was getting ready to leave and he shot himself. She was getting ready to leave and he shot himself, the kids and her. You hear these murder suicides too often and you wonder, my God, how? And it's not because it just happened. It's not because that person snapped. It's because this was brewing behind closed doors for many years, for many days, and this was the end result, but not the end result there, because it's not a snapshot in a news magazine or 5 o'clock news. There's ramifications after that. So for me, it didn't end there. He did try to break into my apartment, because 2 weeks later, he had been calling me repeatedly on my phone. And I finally picked up and I told him that I was through. This was the first time that I had voiced to him that I was through. And that sent him into a frenzy, that I, you know, I changed my locks, because I really was at my breaking point after that last attack. And so he tried to break into my apartment, but not before he went to the basement of the building and cut the phone lines there, because he wanted to make sure I didn't have any access to call once he got in there. I finally called the police. And even then I didn't give him up. I said somebody was trying to break into my apartment. I was trying to give this man every ample opportunity to just leave me alone. I just wanted to be safe. I didn't want it anymore. Then he wasn't hearing it. So now once he saw that the police had come and he knew that I wasn't bluffing on you know, making good on what I was telling him on the other side of the door, as he tried to use a crowbar to break in, you know, to break between the locks, he then started to stalk me. And so it was in the form of leaving derogatory notes on my car, like really nasty stuff that I'm sometimes ashamed to repeat, but this is what it was. And at that point, I knew that even though I felt safe within my doors, I knew he could physically come from anywhere if he could find my car, leave those type of notes on it. And I that's when I finally decided to file for a restraining order. And that kept him away, you know, the law, the actual law.
Was that the first time you actually told somebody who he was and what he was doing to you?
Yeah. So there was a girlfriend of mine that had moved into the neighborhood where I lived on the side street behind our building. And she was a high school friend. And I talk about in the book being a support to someone when they're going through this issue and what kind of support is needed. And she offered that support. Now, I never told her succinctly what was happening. I always sort of alluded to the fact that, you know, things were great. Again, we weren't best friends, but we were friends enough that he didn't he didn't see her as a threat. So she was probably one of the only girlfriends I was allowed to talk with on the phone. Not too long of conversations because he didn't, you know, wasn't going for that at any point. But she knew, like, by the time I finally fessed up that he was stalking me and leaving these notes on the car, because she had seen one of the notes one morning before I even got out there. That's when I had to finally come on and say, and she was like, I knew it. She says, I knew. She said, there was something off about that guy. She said, and she's the one that counseled me to get a restraining order. She was like, you have to do something. She said, because he's going to keep coming. And that's what I did. I called in sick one day and I went into the courthouse. Didn't have any idea what I was doing. So I talk about this in the book as well, like going through the whole process of keeping yourself safe and how daunting that can be, you know, showing up at the courthouse and having to talk to the clerk and ask her, you know, so what do I do now? And so I, you know, you have to write an affidavit. Okay. I, you know, 23 years old, trying to, you know, sound educated about to make the judge understand that this, I'm really in danger and I need this protective order.
Right.
And then being told when you're done filling out the paperwork that you have to come back. And so I'm like, wait a minute. I thought, because I don't know. I thought once I fill this thing out that you would give it to the judge and then the judge would just, you know, let him know that
like,
he can't come to me. I didn't know I had to come back and face him in court. Like, my God. Mm. I mean, died again inside, because I'm saying to myself, now I have to face this man who, for all intent purposes, has been trying to hurt me, to harm me further than what he already did. You're telling me I have to be in the same room with him and then we have to leave the courthouse and he could potentially just do something to me outside? I was done. Emotionally, I was a wreck, but I went through with it. I did go to court. I did get a year restraining order. And again, he did adhere to it. And I think that was his tipping point. Like, my God, she's like, she went to this length. But she's serious. You know, many people don't get that chance, right, Victoria? Yeah. I mean, you hear these stories that she went to court and then the next day she found her dead. She was supposed to show up for the court hearing, but nobody could find her. Like, you know, it's sick. It's insane that the onus responsibility is on victims to keep themselves safe. But safe, we must try. And right. That's why it's so important to do the work that I do now on raising awareness and helping people navigate the system and pointing people in the right direction for help. Because I remember, again, when help was presented to me, that the unknown to me was insanely scary. And, you know, thank God that he sort of, you know, had this plan for my life, because I could have easily, if the water got too hot, I think I easily would have gone back to him if I had gotten to a point where stuff was just too hot for me to deal with. And oftentimes victims do go back. It takes an average for victims to leave 7 to 10 times because they've gotten to a point where, like, Jesus, this is too much. You know, even though he beat me, he took care of the kids. Even though he beat me, he's a good provider. Even though he beat me, he pays the bills. Like, there's all these, even though he beats me, he brought me here to the States, you know, and you know, all these things that why victims stay, right? And that should never be the question. It should always be, why do abusers do the things that they do? And why aren't they getting help and being held more accountable for their actions?
I think that's what it boils down to, the accountability and them being held more accountable for their actions, right? And thankfully, you know, your story that is one that ended in the best of scenarios, it ended well, right? Because the law actually stopped him.
Yeah.
Right. So maybe the law, you know, and also there's the if there wasn't a shame and stigma around victims, maybe you would have been able to come forward sooner or when it started and use the law to stop him at that point. You know, so I mean, there's a lot of it's multi-layered. Like, it's societal, it's familial, it's all of those things that we grow up with, that we witness, that we hear, that we're conditioned to what we're conditioned for, and what reality is sometimes don't match up. But we're afraid to talk about the difference and how it's hurting us.
Exactly.
You know, I'm thankful that you're using your voice to now help and inspire other people to take that step.
Yeah.
Like, when you hit your breaking point, and like you said, like, you easily could have gone back if the water got too hot, you easily could have gone back. But like, there's also a strength in knowing that you can take your power back. It's just you have to try and take it. there's a different kind of strength that comes in knowing that if I stay here, I'm going to die. So I think I want to live.
Yep.
You know,
exactly.
So let me ask you this, like, what is something that you would say to your 21-year-old self in hindsight?
Trust yourself, trust your gut. If I'd listened to it, I believe in my heart, if I'd listened to it just a little bit more, that I would have made better decisions. Even again, right from the beginning, when I kept doubting myself about his apology, about what had happened, trusting that there was nothing normal about being slapped for telling the truth. Just from the onset, like, my God, if I had just listened to myself. And 21 or not, you know, at the time, our gut leads us and steers us the right way a lot of the times. And if I just paid attention to it, I would tell my 21-year-old self, trust myself a little bit more.
That's really good advice. I mean, even if this is not your particular situation, it's just trusting yourself and knowing that you have the power within you to guide yourself. You know, there's God has built in that compass for us. We just have to listen to what it's called intuition.
Amen. Amen.
You know, after you listen to this podcast, go look up her book, The Legacy He Left Me. Like, it's going to shock you in the first moments of it. And then once you take it in, you'll understand what it is and why that was chosen. But I want you, if you could just walk us through why you chose to use the mask as the cover. It is jarring when you first see him, like, ooh, what happened? Oh, okay. It's makeup and, you know, so talk us through that decision and why it was important to tell your story.
Yeah. And so there were a lot of layers to the cover itself. The concept was came about from my publisher. That's Paperclip Publishing. And when they initially presented it to me, I wasn't a fan, because I know what that type of image, now we hadn't shot it yet. We just talked about sort of the concept and what was being described to me, I could already see in my head. And I really wasn't a fan because I know how something like that would be triggering for me potentially if I saw that as a survivor, as a former victim. And so, the more and more we talked about it, the more they stated that, you know, if you got something bright to wear with it, so you could sort of balance out, you know, I said, okay. I said, you know, I do like yellow, right? So we start talking and we're developing it more. And on the day that we shot it, it was in Arizona, and they brought in a special effects person for one half of the face and then a makeup person for the other half. And once they were done and they gave me the mirror, I was just as I knew how I would feel. I saw not just myself, I saw my mom, I saw other victims that we've met over the years through doing this work with Love Life Now. Not that their faces look like that per se, but the pain that they've walked with, the mask that they've also worn. And so again, in choosing, you know, ultimately going with that concept, I wanted to show one, for me personally, that the trajectory that my father sent me on before I even had a choice was there way beforehand. This is what, you know, in my face, this is what you were leaving for me from behind. Granted, you wanted us to follow in your footsteps, articulation, be educated, all of that. What I ultimately took from you was how to receive love, the legacy you left me, right? And attitudes and behaviors around adult relationships. But then on the onset, when you look at it, like you said, Victoria, is the idea that we are walking around with these, granted, they're not visible to the naked eye, but all this stuff, emotional scars underneath that people can't see because you're having to present like everything's okay on the onset, on the other half of your face or the other half of your life. And so that was really sort of the idea around the concept, was to show that. And it doesn't have to be with just domestic violence. It could be sexual assault. It can be molestation. It could be any trauma that you've experienced in your life. Those scars that you're left with long after the abuse or the trauma has ended, is still there unless you deal with it. The post, our most recent social media post this morning on the Legacy He Left Me page, Instagram and Facebook, talks about the documentary that I watched over the weekend, the Tina Turner documentary.
I saw that.
Oh my God, I swear to God, it was like, in many parts, I was looking at my life. I was looking at my mother's life play out in front of me through her story. And the clips that I shared was of her saying that, you know, having to write the book, and also, you know, she has a movie, What's Love Got to Do with It, with Angela Bassett. Having this, her story told in those two sort of two parts of her life, it was like, God, it's already out there. And the reason that I put it out there is because I don't want to revisit it again. And then you hear Oprah's voice in the next clip that I included that says, you know, that, you know, if you don't deal with the trauma or the pain that you've experienced in your life, it will keep rising, you know, rearing its ugly head, so to speak. And it will continue to bleed, right? Because the trauma continues to rise up in different areas of your life. And you wonder, like, oftentimes, like, my God, why am I like this? It's because you haven't addressed your stuff. And so the cover, just for me, I wanted it to say that we all have stuff, and it's ugly and it's not pretty on one hand. But on the other hand, if you continue to just present with that everything's okay, that stuff is just going to keep building and building and building. And it's eventually going to, again, rear its ugly head in different forms of your life. And have you not understand why?
Right.
So that's the cover concept.
Well, I mean, it's a really powerful image. And I think, you know, like you've so, you know, explained, when you look at it and you really sit with it, it takes you through that journey, and like, you know what it's about when you see it, but there's layers to that image. Right. And it's peeling back those layers.
The layers. Yeah.
You know, and I'm thankful that you're telling your story and you're sharing your story, and the work that you're doing now is around helping other people, inspiring them to live life on their own terms. Like, you don't have to be this person. You don't have to be a victim. Mm-hmm. There's life on the other side of that. So I wonder for you now. Yeah. I wonder for you now, with your mom and everything that you've gone through, and everything that you said to yourself in the beginning, it wasn't that bad. Like, if you had, and I'm sure, you know, because you work with your mom in your foundation, correct? Or your mom works with you. So I don't want to assume that you've had the conversation around her abuse and your abuse, but like, what was that conversation like? And what was that like a release for you to talk about it with her?
Mm-hmm.
Having had the same experience.
Yeah, that's a good question. And so there were two times that we had really honest conversations around it, one-on-one. So, because we have it all the time as it relates to, you know, the work that I do now. But the first time I asked her, it was maybe, you know, a little after our father passed away. So, you know, he died natural causes in a hospital room by himself, alone in Trinidad. Right. So that's karma, right? at the age of 50 years old. So he was really young when he passed away. And so, you know, I asked her, I said, you know, why did you stay through it all? This is before I started doing this work and understanding the issue a little bit more. And she said, you know, where was I going to go with five children? Who was going to take care of you all? She said, I barely had an education, and he was the financial breadwinner, and I needed you guys to have a chance at life, and I wouldn't have been able to do that for you. So in her mind, she was thinking that she was presenting the best opportunities for us to excel under his, you know, his homeship. But we really weren't. And I tell my own story because I can tell my own story. You know, this issue affected our family in many different ways, but I can only speak for myself. And so, no, it wasn't a good thing that we grew up, you know, with a two-parent household and him financially being, there was more to being a parent than that. And that's something that he never understood, even up until he died, I think, you know? And then years later, once I started doing this work, I understood how not good it was to ask her that question. That question should have never been posed to her, but I didn't know that at the time. So, you know, maybe about 7 years ago, we talked again around it. And I said, I'm sorry. I apologized to her because that was not for me to ask you. You were in fight or flight mode, trying to survive. And I get it. I get it now, not because I went through the same exact situation, but I get how mentally messed up you were, because of him. Right. And, you know, I also had asked a question of him when I was 18 and I returned to Trinidad to get my permanent residency. I had built up enough courage after he first tried to attack her that first time. I went to him a couple, you know, days later and I said, why did you treat mommy the way you did all those years? And he gave me the most, I swear, again, watching the Tina Turner documentary was like watching my father when I heard Ike speak. Because he gave this, I heard an interviewer ask him, Tina Turner says that you abused her. Mm-hmm. And why? The basic question was why? And he, just like Ike, gave this a roundabout, up and down the world and a slide and around and answer that made zero sense, that also placed blame on her. And I stood there. And it was because a car was coming, somebody was coming to visit him that interrupted our conversation. But I stood there and I sat with that and I was infuriated. Because in my mind, I'm 18, but how dare you blame her for what you did to her? She was never the blame. I understood that then. And again, like I said, accountability is where it's at for abusers because they never, you know, it's always somebody else's fault because you made me do this. If you not realizing that it's their, you know, whatever they're walking around with that they are, you know, portraying and, you know, giving to others. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for sharing that. And thank you for sharing your story. And again, thank you for not just here, but just being an advocate for victims and an advocate for their freedom and advocate for them to become advocates for their own freedom. Amen. So I have a couple more questions for you and then we're going to wrap up. The first question I have is, you know, what is it like for you now today on the other side of this, living life on your own terms? Like, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I call myself a thriver, right? I'm not just surviving, I am thriving. And I do that after God because he really brought me to a place to understand that what happened to me was not because of me. And it took a while to get there. I sought therapy for myself initially. This was 2008, 2009, I went to a therapist to break down what I had been through. Like, really? What did I really have a part to play in any of this? And she helped me sort of navigate that space at that time. And a few years later, I met my husband through mutual friends of ours. And we got married and we have two children. My daughter is 19 and our son is 7 years old. And I gotta say, It is refreshing to be in a relationship that is equal, that doesn't look to take from me personally, but that I can give wholeheartedly because I want to, and vice versa. It is refreshing to be with someone who understands that I have boundaries. and respect them and vice versa. So everything, right, bounces off each other and it is not by any means perfect. That's first and foremost. We have disagreements. We fight sometimes, but we agree to disagree at the end of the day and we leave it there. Sometimes we revisit it. We went to premarital counseling before we got married. And one of the practices that we took from that counseling was to table things, right? So even if at the end of the day, things don't necessarily make sense to you and you're not really feeling it, you say, let's table this for Thursday. Let's come back when cooler heads can prevail. And let's just talk about this next week. Cause I want to, I really want, us women, we really don't want to let things go.
Well, yeah. I mean, we're usually right though.
Right? So I want to talk about this again on Friday. Thanks. Right. Let me pencil that in. But so that's worked really well for us. So, you know, just finding ways that you can coexist, because again, when you come into relationships, I don't care what they are, you're two different people coming from two different settings, that, and you're bringing your stuff to come marry my stuff, and our stuff may not look like each other's stuff more than half the time. So I'm just really grateful that I have a partner that respects me, that is honest and trustworthy, and again, all vice versa, shares responsibility across the board. I mean, sometimes he thinks about me before I think about myself, and that's where love for me comes in. Love is an action word. It is not, you know, I had to understand that it isn't something that you throw around, a word that you throw around, that, you know, no, how are you doing things to let the other person know that you really, truly care about them and their well-being? So yeah, for now, I am completely in a great space, but I say that because I'm able to love myself first. And that was a big part of being good or feeling good in this relationship, because I know at the end of the day that I'm okay with me. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with me. And I want you to be okay with you.
And we can be okay with each other.
And that's, if that concept went around, and this is what we try to teach, we do healthy relationship workshops for teens, you know, teen dating violence is a thing. So we try to raise awareness around that and help to try prevent the cycle of violence where maybe, you know, even if it's been, you know, being seen in their homes, maybe we try to curb it with those types of workshops, but we also do it for adults. And we try to teach people, about the signs of abuse and, you know, learning from my personal experience and now where I am as a thriver, about what healthy relationships can look like. And so, yeah, you know, I run the foundation now. We've been doing this work now for the past 10 years. You know, it's passion work for me, Victoria.
Yeah.
If I can shout from the rooftops, there's a post on my personal page that I put up of our son asking me last week, Friday, after he was done with one of his classes, he's been homeschooled. And he said to me, he read about Congresswoman Chisholm. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't understand. He's like, why can't you run to be a congresswoman? If you did, like, everybody would listen to you and abuse could be stopped for good. Mm. He's 7 years old.
If the seven-year-old gets it, it's such a simple concept.
Like, my God, you know?
Just stop it.
Just stop, right?
Just
and
stop
so,
it. Yeah.
You know, we try, you know, and that's another thing is that I say is that, you know, making this conversation normalized within our homes as well, with our boys, right, with our girls, that, you know, abuse is wrong in any way, shape, or form. If you like a girl, you do not pull on her hair, you do not hit her, this is not cute, this is not the way that you talk to people, you know, and just making again the conversation logical, so that when he goes to school, he can then have those conversations with his peers, 7 years old or not.
Right.
And it becomes normal. So as when he gets to college, he knows the issue of consent is where it's at, right?
Right.
It's not a thing where your buddies, you know, take her up to the room, get her drunk and all this other stuff. No, that's not gonna be cool because this is what I've been
hearing. He's the voice of reason.
That's it. And you know, we want to normalize that conversation from home as well. So
that's awesome. Like, thank you for the work that you do, because there really needs to be not just education, but really the destigmatization of, you know, being a victim and allowing victims to use their voice, giving them permission, allowing them to give themselves permission to use their voice. And when they do so, act. When they do so, hold the abusers accountable, because that's really the only way the cycle is going to stop. Like when people know that there's a consequence for their behavior, not all the time, but it's a deterrent. You think twice about it. And if you're gung-ho about being a jerk, then you go forward with your actions.
Yeah.
But at least it will deter some people from making that, you know, that next act of violence that may eventually put somebody in the grave. Like,
exactly.
It really is. It sounds so simple. And like I said earlier, like it sounds easier said than done, but it just doesn't make any sense to me that you think this is okay. And this is, you know, having power and control over somebody is the only way for you to get them to love you.
To love and respect you.
You know, I think therapy should be part of the curriculum growing up, period.
Oh, gosh.
Like it should just be a citizen's right, because there's some re-educating, there's the reshaping, there's the, at the family level, at the society level, at the government level, like, are these issues important enough, you know, for you to be taken seriously? Just you talking about your experience with, for the first time walking to the courthouse and how daunting that was. You could have easily just said, you know what, I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not coming back. And then if you don't come back, they throw your case out.
That's it.
You know, so there's so many different layers to this. So thank you very much for the work that you do, because I feel like it's needed and necessary and important. And I'm thankful that I can sit with you today thriving and hear about how you thrive and, you know, all of those wonderful things. So the last question I have for you, I know Love Life Now is a foundation that helps, you know, provide resources and connects the shelters and the communities that they serve. What are some resources for people who might not have the courage yet, or they're building the courage to make that first step? What are someone they can call or a place they can visit to take the act to get out of the terrible situation that they may find themselves in?
Yeah. So if you are at that point where you're thinking that you've had enough, kudos to you, because it's not an easy place to get to. You've been barraged by your abuser for many times, months, years, that if you leave, that you'll be nothing without them. But I can tell you that they're lying to you. So they do not want you to speak up. That's how they thrive, is on your silence. So the time, if you're thinking about getting out, kudos to you. When you are at that point, if you're just looking for information, there are a number of ways that you can get in touch with someone to start the process, or to start, again, seeing what your options are. I always like to ask folks, no matter where they are in the States, to reach out to the National Domestic Violence Hotline. It's 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E, 1-800-799-SAFE. And you can, even if you don't want to pick up the phone to call, you can text to chat with someone and they can help you find the advocate or the domestic violence agency in your area to talk to someone at their 24/7 hotline. So when you pick up the phone, don't let it be daunting. I know you're talking to a stranger, but you're calling and you're picking up the phone and you're asking, you're saying, you don't even have to give your name. You can call anonymously. And you can say, listen, I am just thinking about leaving. What are my options? Is there a shelter if I want to leave for my kids? Is there space there currently? An advocate can help you safety plan. So sort of gather up important documents that you might have to take with you, things for the kids, maybe help you get some financial assistance if there's none available at that point. Leaving isn't as easy as 1, 2, 3. It's not black and white, right? So there's a lot of steps into leaving and leaving safely. So getting in contact with an advocate in your area. If you're not at that point yet, you don't want to talk to a stranger, you've heard this podcast and you want to talk to me, pick up the phone and call me. You can also text me at 888-LLN-9876. That's 888-LLN-9876. And you can find that number on our website, lovelifenow.org. lovelifenow.org. So text me, have a conversation, say I'm trying to figure out what next steps are and I can help you. I can be your liaison. You call, you get me. You text, you get me. And then if that's not an option, maybe visiting the domestic violence agency in your town All you have to do, again, is go onto the National Domestic Violence Hotline website, and you can put in your area code and find out what that is. And then just going onto their website and seeing what services they offer. And some of the agencies do have text to chat available as well. So again, there's a myriad of ways. Sometimes if you don't, you know, you don't have the option to talk on the phone, you can't text, you want to meet somebody in person, they can help you with that. A lot of these agencies meet you where you're at. So, you know, maybe meeting at a Dunkin', or, you know, while your abuser's at work and after you've dropped the, you know, your daughter or your son to school, they can meet you at a Dunkin' to talk about safety planning, because you don't want to leave a digital footprint on your phone because your abuser may monitor that. There's so many areas and avenues of ways that you can go, but the first step takes you picking up the phone and wanting that help. So I urge you just to speak up. You have power in your voice more than you know.
Thank you so much for that.
Yeah,
really appreciate that. And we'll make sure to link all of those resources in the description, so that if you're listening, you have the choices that Laverne has mentioned in the description for you to just click on and follow through on.
Most definitely. Yeah.
Thank you. So my very last question for you is, what are you looking forward to?
Oh, man. Just in general or in life?
However, wherever.
Anything? Okay. Yeah. Gosh, just so much. I just got my first dose of the vaccine, so I'm excited about the next dose.
Yeah, okay.
For those that are vaccine fans, not everybody is, but yeah.
I'm anti-pandemic, anti-COVID. So anything that's that, I am team. What you got?
Team Give Pfizer it to me. Over here. Team Pfizer.
I don't know. I think I got my first dose too. I think I get the two and a half more weeks for the next dose. I'm not sure what I got. I think I got Moderna.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. So that's a big one right there. Someone just called me the other day, and granted, I've been out safely doing certain things. Someone called me yesterday and said, you know, I wanted to invite you to a dinner next week for my birthday. And, you know, I know how you and your husband are. And I said, nope, I got my first dose. I can come. I have no problems coming. She was so excited because she was expecting for me to say no. I said, no, I'm coming. Yeah. So anyway, so there's that. And then the book release, you know, I'm excited for it to be out there. We're still trying to map out what, you know, not necessarily that we're going to do anything sort of physical, because come June 1st, that's when it's being officially released, but it's in pre-order status right now. I just want folks to have it. I want folks to read it. I just want folks to be educated again, Victoria. It's so within me to just get people educated. And I know if they have this book, it just doesn't tell my story. It gives all these nuggets about, you know, self-care and, you know, what ACEs are, and explaining that, so that these things that are in there kind of will help folks not navigate, but like connect what's happening to them with the clinical terms, so that they can speak like, oh, that's what that is. Oh, that's what he did. Oh, that's what that sign is. All of these things to sort of get you in the know, even if you've never experienced this issue. So yes, I'm excited about the book. So go to thelegacyheleftme.com and you can see more information about it there. It's in pre-order status right now.
So yes,
those are the two things.
Awesome. And I'm excited to receive my copy of the book as well. Yes. So I'm very excited to read it. That's going to be one of my summer reads. Thank you so much. This has been such an amazing conversation. And thank you for being so transparent and just willing to lay it all out. Like, at this point, I'm grateful and thankful that you're using your story to empower others. Amen. Because I think that's what it is. Like, you've gone through the experience. You could just go on with your life and live a good life, but you've chosen to do this work to help other people gain their freedom and give themselves permission to live life on their own terms. So thank you so much for that. Just as a, you know, as a sign out, tell the folks where they can find you, follow you, read more about you, sign up for your mailing list, get the book, all of the above.
Everything can be found on lovelifenow.org. all of our social media links are on there. And the book, as I said, which there's a link to it there as well, it is thelegacyheleftme.com, and all the social media links for the book are on that page. So Visit us on the web and get connected with us. We love people on the social media platform because, again, that's where we tend to try to normalize the conversation. Even if you're never saying a word, the fact that you're there and seeing and watching, that's more than half the battle. Yeah. So thank you.
Awesome. And we'll make sure to link all of your social media and your website in the description so y'all can go follow her, stay in touch, stay connected, stay engaged. If you know somebody who needs this message, please pass it on to them. They don't have to listen to the whole podcast, even though I think that the whole episode, even though I think they should. You know, there's a lot in here that could save somebody's life, you know, and the resources alone, just knowing that you have another choice than what you're in right now. And it just takes you reaching out. And I say it just when it's not that simple. And I think, you know, we can't overstate the fact that it's not as simple as just saying it, right? It's you been sick of it and just saying, you know, I think I'm good. You know, it's reaching your breaking point, like you said, you know, Laverne. Yeah. So thank you so much. We're going to go ahead and wrap up. I really do appreciate you again. And for my folks who are listening in, thank you for tuning in with every episode. I appreciate you. If you have any questions, concerns, thoughts, feedback for Laverne, go ahead to her website and her social media and let her know, and then come back over here and let me know too. All right. You can also email me at The Village Talk, at victoria@thevillagetalk.com. And if there's anything else if there's anything that I can support you with, you know to reach out to me. Until next time, I'll talk to y'all soon. Bye-bye.